was making this person a non-voting member of the commission. Okay. Okay, any other questions? Thank you. I put you on first because Ms. Brazo promised me that you, we didn't want to keep three state agency people here and you could all now go back to work, so.
Thank you.
Or go get a cup of coffee, whatever you decide. Going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 384A. We're going to open a work session. Chair would move Senate Bill 384A to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? We'll move the bill to the full committee.
Carry.
I'll carry it.
Schedule group in a packet. So I'll be quick. 342, 352, 353.
Okay, we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 342 today. 352 and 353A. And I think I've got the same group of people signed up on all of those. Connie Gallagher, Mary Elledge, Holm, anyway, and Ann Pratt. Apologize for not being able to read your writing.
So, can I be clear? Is it 352 and 353 only?
We'll open a public hearing on 342, okay. 352, and 353.
Thank you.
Please, whichever one of you would like to start, please start and identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Connie Gallagher, Director of Crime Victims Assistance Section with the Department of Justice. I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bills 342, 352, and 353. All three bills make relatively small changes in the administration of the Crime Victims Compensation Program. However, while they do not affect a large number of victims, and they certainly don't have a significant fiscal impact, these changes are very important to the specific victims or to the surviving family members who are directly affected by the current statutory language. In order to understand these bills, I'd like to just briefly mention several of the key points relative to the administration of the Crime Victims Compensation Program. This program was established in 1977 for primarily two purposes. The first is to ease the financial losses to victims of violent crime. And this is done through reimbursement of out-of-pocket costs that victims incur as a result of their victimization. It is not an insurance program. The second primary goal is to encourage victims to participate in criminal justice proceedings because it is through their participation that we're able to hold offenders accountable for the consequences of their actions. This program is always the payer of last resort. The statute set financial limits on the amount of compensation payments that can be paid out to victims. The program is not funded with general funds, but it's funded through the fines, penalties, and judgments that are ordered by the court against defendants and criminal offenders. Now, getting into Senate Bill 342, this bill makes a small change in statute, but one that will contribute to holding offenders accountable for the consequences of their actions without jeopardizing future civil action that a victim may want to take against the offender. What it does is allow the Department of Justice to proceed with an independent cause of action against the defendant for recovery of the department's crime victims compensation costs that have been paid out on behalf of victims. The policy is already in statute. However, we believe that there needs to be a small tweak to the statute in order for us to be able to proceed with the authority that's provided in the statute. Presently, we do not use this method, the method of civil suit, as a method of recovery due to the danger of this action preventing a victim from later being able to file their own civil suit. A good example might be a case of child sex abuse where perhaps the program has paid out approximately $3,000 on medical costs, counseling costs. We would like to be able to proceed with an action to recover those costs from the offender. However, we've been reluctant to do that because that might preclude the victim from later filing his or her own civil suit, and obviously that civil suit could be worth a great deal more. So this bill does not request a significant change in policy, but it would be one more tool that would be available to us to, number one, hold offenders accountable, number two, increase revenue for victims, and also be assured that victims can proceed with their own right of action should he or she decide to do so. Mr. Chair, would you like me to proceed with testimony on the next bill? Or?
Yes, if you would, please.
Senate Bill 352 also requests a very small change, and this pertains to the length of time that a claim that has been accepted can remain open in order for a victim to apply for compensation. It does not request a change in the terms of the financial benefits. Those statutory limits would remain intact. In most cases, the 3 years that are presently allowed by statute are adequate in order for victims to receive the services and thus the compensation that they might be entitled to. However, there are a very few number of cases where a victim has had catastrophic injuries, and we know that the cost of that recovery will extend beyond the 3 years. An example of that is a U of O co-ed that applied for compensation. This young lady was hit broadside by a drunk driver. She had severe injuries, including permanent damage to several limbs. In an effort to save her legs, she was going to have a series of operations over an extended period of time. Her insurance would not provide for the full cost of the surgeries, although it was certainly used before crime victims' compensation payments were made. With the current language, crime victims' compensation would not be able to assist with the out-of-pocket expenses beyond the 3-year life of the claim. So again, we ask that this bill be passed in order to allow us to draft administrative rules that would define catastrophic injuries and also allow the department to extend the length of benefit eligibility. And again, while it is not a large number of victims that would be eligible for the extended benefit period, for those that are, the removal of this administrative barrier is a significant benefit. The last bill I will mention is Senate Bill 353. And I'm here speaking on behalf of surviving family members of victims of crime to request an additional change to the Crime Victims Compensation Program. This bill asks for a small change in statute that would provide the program with the discretion to reduce or deny compensation payment when it's appropriate without requiring that the program be overly punitive by enforcing reduction for contribution on the part of the victim when it serves no purpose. And in fact, what you will hear from the other witnesses is that it can be detrimental to surviving family members. When the compensation program reviews a claim, we review several actions on the part of the victim. Before we even accept the claim, we review a victim's action to make sure that they were not engaged in a wrongful act or an unlawful act at the time of the victimization. An example of this might be a person who is selling drugs or engaged in a robbery at the time that they were shot. And again, if the facts of the case based on a police report, contact with the detectives, with the district attorney indicate that the victim who's applied for compensation was engaged in a wrongful act, the application is denied in full. Also, in regards to the victim's actions, we look to see whether the victim substantially provoked their attack or their assailant. And again, if the facts of the case show that the victim did, in fact, substantially provoke the attack that resulted in their injuries, again, the application will be denied in full. So it is only after a victim has met all of the eligibility criteria, including reporting to police, cooperating with prosecution, not being engaged in a wrongful act, not substantially provoking the act, that we then look at whether the victim's actions contributed to their own victimization. And the result of this decision will affect the payments that are made rather than the eligibility. These are situations where the victim may have shown a lack of judgment, but it is the type of lack of judgment that all of us are guilty of at one time or another in our life. And in the situations that are of most concern to us, the victim has paid the ultimate price. The victim has died as a result of the victimization, and you could say in part their poor judgment. The statutory language at the moment leaves no room for discretion in terms of reducing the compensation payments when there is a statement of fact that the victim did contribute directly or indirectly to their victimization. Senate Bill 353 would provide discretion for the program to review each case individually and under certain circumstances be able to fully compensate the victim or surviving family member who's the applicant. And as I said, the cases where this is most likely include those where the victim is deceased. These are the cases we are concerned about because, first of all, the victim is unable to provide their own explanation of the course of events that resulted in the injuries and, in this case, ultimately their death. Secondly, there is no public good to be gained by giving the message that you, the victim, showed poor judgment and made a decision that in some small way may have contributed to the resulting injuries. And third, the compensation should go to grieving family members who are trying to pay for the cost of medical services, counseling, and funeral bills that are the result of a criminal act that claimed the life of their loved one. Senate Bill 353, the A engrossed version, if passed, will result in better policy and also access to needed services for surviving family members of deceased victims of crime. And I thank you for your consideration of these three bills. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Which one of you would like to go next?
You don't forget, I'll pick up anything.
Sure. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Ann Pratt, and I am from Lane County. I'm a member of Crime Victims United and also Mothers Against Drunk Driving, but I'm here today speaking on my own behalf and as a secondary victim of a homicide. I am in support of Senate Bills 342, 352, and 353. Extending the time limit for a crime victim's catastrophic injury can only lead to a more complete recovery, both physically and emotionally, with no additional cost to the program. I also certainly believe crime victims compensation programs should be able to recover from offenders any funds paid out to their victims without compromising the victim's chances in a civil suit. My main purpose in coming here today is to ask you to please pass Bill 353. It is my hope my experience will convince you of the necessity of revising the statute regarding victim contribution. On September 18, 1998, a drunk driver killed my 23-year-old son. I cannot begin to describe in words the intense, devastating pain and anguish associated with losing my child, my son, in this way. I was heartbroken. I had always thought of myself as resilient, but at that point in time, I questioned my own ability to survive. At the insistence of both Deschutes County and Lane County Victims Assistance, I applied to the Crime Victims Compensation Program in behalf of all Brian's family members. The drunk driver had no insurance. Our medical insurance did not cover counseling. If we were ever again to return to functioning and productive members of society, we would need help. The criminal trial was coming up in just a few short weeks. We would need to find the strength to attend. It was December 1998, just 3 months after Brian's death. I received a letter of denial in January of 1999 from Crime Victims Compensation Program. It said, my son, Brian Hood, contributed to his own death by getting into the vehicle of a drunk driver. It also went on to say, had Mr. Hood been sober, he may have been able to make a more responsible decision in regarding his own safety. They had the BAC report stating Brian was not intoxicated. I couldn't believe what I had just read. Crime Victims Compensation determined their finding of facts and conclusions by using the early police reports, which included the word of the highly intoxicated driver, who immediately began blaming the victim he had just killed. Much of the decision was based on his statement and accepted as fact. Therefore, the denial was filled with inaccuracies, and I felt it was unnecessarily cruel. I was informed I could argue for an appeal, but the damage was already done. The compensation program had caused an immeasurable amount of additional duress. How was I supposed to appeal when I hardly had the strength to breathe, and I had a criminal trial to attend? I never expected to be treated in this way. I remember thinking they didn't have to do this. They clearly didn't understand what actually happened that night. They didn't even know my son, and he wasn't even here to defend himself. Brian was a big, gentle guy with a kind heart. His death devastated three families, a multitude of friends in several communities, co-workers, the crew he supervised. The impact was huge. Even though there were circumstances and facts he was unaware of, and were beyond his control that evening. There was no one in our families who would argue that perhaps Brand used poor judgment in getting into the vehicle, but he had already paid the ultimate price. I understand the statute was originally written so criminals would not benefit from this program, but my son committed no crime, or ever had for that matter. He was the victim. It is unreasonable and unfair to expect the deceased victim of a crime to accept the responsibility for his own death or to unwittingly be forced to share the offender's guilt. It seems it is still at times just too acceptable to blame the victim. We just didn't expect it in the year 1999 from a state agency whose mission statement professes to help crime victims. We certainly could have used some assistance and compassion. I have always believed that guilt or innocence rightfully should be assessed at the criminal trial. The judge had the following to say to the convicted offender at his sentencing. I don't want you to think, or in any way Brian's family and friends to think, that Brian Hood was responsible for this tragedy in any way, because he was not. I received an apology from Crime Victims Compensation, but that is not enough. We, the family of Brian Hood, want this to happen to another family, do not want this to happen to another family. We believe the Crime Victims Compensation Program is a well-meaning, beneficial program. We don't believe the original intention was ever to further punish or harm in any way the grieving, incapacitated families of deceased victims who have committed no crimes, but that is what is happening. This is a very negative action, and it is wrong. The bill has been amended to eliminate the department's requirement to categorically assess victim contribution, but instead leaves it to their discretion on a case-per-case basis. Senate Bill 353 puts Crime Victims Compensation Program in sync with the great strides society has made in addressing victims' needs. Please choose to make this positive change. Please pass Senate Bill 353. Thank you for listening.
Thank you, Ms. Pratt.
Hello, Mr. Chairman and members. I would like to thank you for allowing me to speak today. My name is Mary Elledge, and I'm chapter leader of Parents of Murdered Children. I've been chapter leader for over 11 years. 15 years ago, my only son, Rob, was murdered in our home. At that time, there was no compensation. So let me say, we certainly have come a long way, but these little touches would help it so much more with these three Senate bills. On civil recovery, there should be sanctions and accountability. I want the state to get back as much as they can, and I do not want the victims to be penalized if the state needs to do this. So I, excuse me, I believe that this bill, you know, pretty much speaks for itself. On Senate Bill 352, please let me tell you that you cannot put a time limit on grief. In homicide cases, we have families who don't even find the body ever, or maybe it's a year or more down the road. They cannot even get to their grief work until maybe years later. Trials stop this, and going to the justice system. So if we would not have a time limit, it would give them and the other members, the children, many sibling survivors that are left, are too young at the time, or not able to be taken to counseling at the time, or it takes a while to get in it. It takes years. It's been 15 years for me, and there's not a day that goes by that I don't think of my son. We received no benefits, as I said, but I was lucky we had insurance, but many of these people don't. So I would hope that they would please keep this in mind, that you cannot put a time limit on grief for their counseling. On Senate Bill 353, I have seen families that were not able to even bury their child because they did not have the funds. One example is where a young man was walking with two people he thought were his friends. These people were gang members. He lived in southeast Portland. There were not, these were his neighbors and who he ran around with. These men decided to murder this young man. They actually hung him from a play yard swing set in one of the public parks. Because they were known gang members, his case was denied. That he was actually used poor judgment and being with these people. These were his only peers and the people that lived in his neighborhood. He had not ever been in trouble before. I know that the victims, services, the victims justice section is, does a fantastic job. We cannot thank them enough. But I would like them to have, with the wording from this bill, that they would have the power to be able to make sure that this does not ever happen again. We have another family in our group whose son was in a car with someone who was intoxicated. They were in an accident. He was thrown from the car. He lived for several hours, but the person who drove the car did not ask for help for this person until he sobered up. The family has been denied any help with this. So I would hope that in passing Senate Bill 353, we would eliminate that and give the surviving members of a family a chance to some type of recovery or some type of a better life. I thank you very much for your time and in consideration in these three bills. I think they will do a lot for victims, and I thank you.
Thank you very much for testifying, all three of you. Are there questions for these witnesses about either Senate Bill 353, 352, or 342? Representative Ackerman.
I have some questions of the agency people, but
That would be Ms. Gallagher from DOJ in the center.
Okay, fine. Thank you. I certainly agree with the amendments to Senate Bill 353, but I really wonder if they go far enough in that I perceive a conflict between ORS 147.125 sub 1 sub 3 where compensation could be partially or fully denied based upon the victim's acts or conduct, but it doesn't describe what type of acts or conduct would be a disqualifier. And as I look over to ORS 147.015 regarding eligibility for compensation, it states that the death or injury to the victim was not substantially attributable to the wrongful act of the victim or substantial provocation. I guess what I'm getting at is that in the eligibility for compensation section, it refers to a wrongful act, and under this later statute, later in sequence, it just says victim's acts. Would the agency be construing the acts or conduct to be wrongful, or are they just going to consider any act of the victim as a prerequisite for the denial or reduction of compensation? Or should we amend the statute to harmonize the two provisions?
Mr. Chair and Representative Ackerman, the wrongful act statute that you read, along with the substantial provocation, has to do with eligibility. And the statute that's included in Senate Bill 353 has to do with the payments that are made after a claim is accepted. So we consider them as three separate types of decisions. Now, if you would like to make adjustments in the eligibility criteria, I'd certainly be open to hearing what you had in mind along that line. But the two don't necessarily connect. If I understand your question correctly, the wrongful act part doesn't necessarily affect the contribution decision around payment.
Okay, let me ask the other witnesses then, if you're following my point, that I do agree with the concept, but my feeling is that allowing the agency to just rule on acts or conduct without any standards just opens the door for further denials or reductions of otherwise meritorious claims. Should we pursue an amendment which would say that the victim's wrongful acts or felonious acts would only be those which would be considered for reduction, or just we leave it wide open and let the agency interpret that?
Do you want us to address that? Is that for Connie?
Sure, for the victims.
What I am finding out and what I have over the years, and especially in working with victims' assistance, is that actually if we could go by their judgment, we'd be all right. It's what when they run into the bills. What I'm trying to say is that they try to give as much as they can to the, I'm speaking mostly now from homicide co-victims, those who are left in the aftermath of homicide, that they actually have done as much as they possibly can, and with these changes, I think they'll be able to do more. I know what you're saying, and I don't want it that the wrong people get this money either, even where I'm coming from. I would like to see them have as much latitude as they could in making decisions on especially homicide co-victims.
Mr. Chair and Representative Ackerman, if an applicant is engaged in a wrongful act, the application is always denied because they were engaged in something unlawful at the time. So that's in statute, and we don't use any discretion in that regards. In regards to contribution, what we would do is draft our policy and change OARs if that's necessary in order to allow us to have the discretion not to reduce, particularly in death cases where the victim's deceased. And you've heard some of the reasons. The victim's unable to provide an accurate explanation. There are all sorts of problems. And right now, in an effort to be consistent, the program has had to make decisions which obviously we're up here requesting a change, which we felt were not good for victims. So I can assure you that we would put into OAR and into policy an appropriate response to those situations where there is contribution. However, the facts of the case are such that it would not serve any good, and perhaps we cannot actually verify the facts to the degree we would like to, and we would be able to be in agreement with what the victim community would like in terms of payments.
I just would like to say that Connie and I have had this discussion, and that I personally do put my faith in the discretion of the program.
Okay. I'll back off my point, but the stories of the victims show, in many instances, I think really arbitrary conduct by the agency in ruling on some of these claims. I also have a suspicion that the due process that you were afforded is inadequate, and you know, it does allow a lot of agency discretion in interpreting what the law is. I'm willing to let it go at this time because I think the bill's a good one and is a step in the right direction, but I would certainly like to revisit this next session to see how these claims are being processed.
I think that would be good.
Give them the benefit of the doubt at this time. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you, ladies. We have one more witness, Arwin Byrd, on Senate Bill 352 and 353, if you'd like to come forward.
Good morning. My name is Arwin Byrd, as you all heard, and I am one of the co-founders of Survivors Advocating for an Effective System. I'm here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 352 and Senate Bill 353. I want first to thank you for hearing these bills. Historically, our system of justice has been very offender-focused. Today, this focus is shifting, but has much further to go to reflect a truly balanced system. Inasmuch as we recognize the harm and facilitate the healing of survivors, our actions and decisions reflect a needed shift in this paradigm. Crime victims' compensation is just one part of this movement. Our organization firmly supports a survivor's right to compensation. These bills would provide a needed extension of that right. The first bill, Senate Bill 352, would simply extend the period of time that a survivor can apply and receive compensation for their injuries. I can testify from a personal experience that the costs of catastrophic injury go far beyond 3, 5, or 8 years after injury. I was diagnosed with osteoporosis 5 years after my injury, a direct result of my paralysis from a drunk driver. This diagnosis requires extensive medication and physical therapy. I use this example to illustrate the arbitrary nature of the current limitation. As survivors, we do not always recognize the extent of an injury within 1, 3, or 10 years. Or if we do, the rehabilitation required may exceed 3 years post-injury. The state of Oregon should also recognize this fact with regards to the compensation it provides survivors of catastrophic injury. The second bill, Senate Bill 353, would remove consideration of a victim's conduct in their death. We support the notion that surviving family members receive compensation for the death of a loved one. How we determine this compensation can be difficult and arduous. Life is not easily divided into black and white distinction. This area of law, determining the degree to which we are responsible for our own injury or death, highlights this fact. Our hope is that we create a system that makes it easier for survivors to get compensation. State systems that support survivors need tools to gauge situations for which compensation is not easily defined. The goal of fairly compensating survivors needs always to remain in focus. Behind every calculation is real suffering and pain. We appreciate your attention to this matter and the desire for a fair system of compensation for the survivors that it represents. Thank you for your attention. My testimony is brief. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Ms. Byrd? Thank you very much. We will close the public hearings on Senate Bill 353, 352, and 342. I'll open a work session on Senate Bill 342. Representative Ackerman.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we pass Senate Bill 342 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Ackerman moves Senate Bill 342 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? The bill will move to the full committee. I'll now open a work session. Senator, Representative Ackerman, will you carry Senate Bill 342?
Yes, happy to.
Now open a work session on Senate Bill 352. Representative Wilson.
I move Senate Bill 352 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Wilson moves Senate Bill 352 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Senate Bill 352 moves to the full committee. Carrier will be Representative Wilson. And I'll open a work session on Senate Bill 353A. Representative Vicki Walker.
I'll move Senate Bill 353 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Vicki Walker moves Senate Bill 353A to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? The bill will move to the full committee. Representative Vicki Walker will carry. We're going to open a work session on House Bill 3642. Colleagues, you'll recall that House Bill 3642 is the criminal forfeiture bill. It's my understanding, and counsel can correct me, it's my understanding that while the parties in the work group working on this bill are close to having all the details worked out, that there are still some small things that are being negotiated. I don't believe we have do we have amendments in front of us?
You do, Chair Williams. You have the dash 5 amendments.
And who is the appropriate couple of people to come up and explain to us what the status is? I assume it's Mr. Penn.
And Mr. Fidanke.
And Mr. Fidanke. Two old favorites here in the Judiciary Committee. I put emphasis on the word old and not on favorites.
And getting older all the time, unfortunately. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Dale Penn. I'm representing the District Attorneys Association. The Dash 5 amendments, I believe, show a lot of consensus activity by the work group. There are two issues that still remain. One of them is that we have tried to narrow somewhat the focus of the bill as far as the amount of crimes that it would apply to. However, we still do need to have a relatively short meeting on narrowing that a little bit more from the Dash 5 amendments. and we're hopeful that we're going to be able to do that today. The second issue is really an issue of concerning the proceeds that have been targeted for drug treatment and how those proceeds would be available to local seizing or government agencies. There is a Senate Bill 914, which is moving through the Senate and I think is on its way to the House at the present time, or still to be voted on in the Senate. And one of the things that bill does is it designates that proceeds from civil forfeiture would be available for drug treatment programs. There is interest by Senator Deckert and the sponsors of Senate Bill 914, as well as the governor's office, to connect that bill in some way to criminal forfeiture. That was discussed very briefly, and there are some major concerns that were raised by the work group members. However, we need to have that discussion a second time. As I understand it, there's some willingness to deal with some of the concerns that were presented by the work group earlier in trying to pull those together. I don't know where that issue is going to end up, but I do think that the bill itself and the list of crimes, we're very close to being done with this, and but we also need to address this other issue that's just come up in the last few days. So that's where we're at. I do think that we will be able to resolve the Dash 5 amendments hopefully today, and then be able to get back to you, and hopefully have a product that we could submit to you as a consensus bill in the very near future.
Mr. Fedenke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, David Fedenke, KSLU of Oregon. If the committee would like, I could go through some of the provisions of the Dash 5 amendments that we believe are not going to change, to give a brief overview of how this process would work.
I think what I'd like to do, Mr. Fedenke, is probably hold on that until we're really ready to go.
That'd be fine.
We'll allocate the appropriate amount of time. It would be my intent to put this bill back on for Tuesday's criminal subcommittee meeting. And I guess my three words of advice to all of you involved in this process, including this issue on the Senate bill with the civil forfeiture and the allocation of the drug money, is that issue needs to be fully resolved by Tuesday. If it's going to be in, work out the details. If it's not going to be in, make that determination. But my three words of advice are sort of tick, tick, tick. That is the ticking of the clock that tells us what a short period of time we have on House bills, which this is, and that we need to get that resolved. So we'll bring you back on Tuesday, and hopefully at that point we'll give you the opportunity to lay it out. How many of you here feel like you're going to have a need to testify in front of this committee about the details of House Bill 3642 when we actually are preparing to move the bill? Raise your hand. Okay, I see Mr. Sugarman's hand is up. Okay, I see. I assume you two will be here. City of Portland, you going to talk or you're not going to talk? I see a hand in the back there. I'm just trying to get a feel for how much time I'm interacting. Mr. McDonald, okay, I see. All right, that sort of gives me an idea of what we're talking about then. Be prepared on Tuesday to talk about the bill, because it's my intent that the committee will take action on this bill in some form Tuesday. I don't think we can wait any longer than that. Okay, thanks, okay, everybody.
Thank you.
Close the work session on House Bill 3642. We're going to open a work session on House Bill 3035. Ask Representative Patridge to come forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We bring you House Bill 3035 with the dash two amendments. I believe that we've worked everything out with criminal defense lawyers on the dash two amendments. This is the Kelly family bill that we talked about surrounding the death of their child and when he was injected with methamphetamine. This is House Bill 3035, the dash two amendments. Mr. Taylor had those amendments drafted. I appreciate the committee working with us. If you want to hear from the defense lawyer, we're getting a thumbs up over the corner. So I think we've got this worked out. I don't have anything else unless there's questions, Mr. Chair. If you'd like me to discuss the substance of the amendments and how we changed them, we changed them to be in better congruence with the criminal statutes. In addition, we added the in section two, number two, we added the defense if it's within 3 years for marijuana that would be a defense.
Okay, Mr. Hauser, you want to come up?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I could add something to it. The dash two amendments are based on the structure and format of 475-995 penalty for distribution to minors.
Okay. Mr. Hauser.
My name is Bill Hauser. I'm with the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I was involved, of course, in the work group that came with this compromise. We feel that it's a reasonable way to address the problem that Representative Patridge brought before the committee.
Okay. Any questions of committee members on this bill or on the dash two amendments? Hearing none, thank you. We are in work session on House Bill 3035. Yes, Representative Patridge.
There is going to be a fiscal there will be a fiscal that is generated on this. I just ask that if that can be done between your subcommittee and your full, otherwise for your full, just send it to Ways and Means directly, and we'll try and do it from there.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
I've talked with Mr. Lemon about that.
Mr. Lemon? Is this going to be over $50,000?
Mr. Chair, Phil Lemon from the Criminal Justice Commission. I would say right now it's going to be real close. We've been able to talk to one county so far, and there's enough indication that there will be enough cases, and it depends how they're sentenced now and what the sentencing pattern would be with this that will give us the answer. But I would say probably it will need to go downstairs.
Horseshoes, hand grenades, and house bills, pretty close. We will, with that, Representative Shirley, take your motion.
Move the dash two amendments to House Bill 3035.
Representative Shirley has moved the dash two amendments to House Bill 3035. Is there any discussion on the amendments? Any discussion on Representative Shirley's motion? Any objection? Bill is amended. Representative Shirley.
Move House Bill 3035 as amended to the full committee with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Shirley moves House Bill 3035 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Bill will move to the full committee.
Carry.
Any volunteers? Carry to the full. If it has to go to Ways and Means, then we don't need a carrier on the floor. I would have recommended Representative Patridge to carry the bill on the floor, but he can do that if it comes out of Ways and Means. So I just need somebody to carry it to the full. Anybody feel comfortable? Representative Shetty.
Sure.
Okay. Senator Corcoran. You are here on Senate Bill 415, am I right? I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 415 and ask you to come forward.
I should probably sit back and shut up until she's done, Mr. Chair.
Well, it would be a first, I think, in my legislative experience with you, Senator, but we'll take your counsel on that.
Thank God there's not weapons in the building.
How do you know?
Yeah. You want to bet?
How much room?
Diane.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Diane Middle, Director of Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. This bill was kind of a housekeeping or a bringing up to date bill, I guess. In the past, the period of time that it allowed for an officer to gain certification was 12 months. Training must begin within 90 days of hire. This bill does not change that at all. But what we have found over time is as the length of time is increasing and the period under which agencies watch officers before requesting certification has increased, it became necessary to get our rules and our statute in line with that. So what this does is it extends the period from 12 months to 18 months that allows that an agency would not have to recommend a person for certification before they had actually completed their field training work in their probationary period. That's pretty much all this does. It's fairly straightforward, and I will pass it on for the amendments, which have nothing to do with that subject.
Okay, good. Senator Corcoran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tony Corcoran, State Senate District 22. Thank you very much for agreeing to hear these amendments. These are Dash 3 amendments, and I believe a packet's been provided. They're fairly straightforward. I'd like to introduce Lieutenant Hackett from the Lane County Sheriff's Office, and he will explain the oversight that occurred and the reason for the amendments. Also, I guess I want to point out that I've worked with Senator Menes, and he's in agreement with the amendments. So even though this was not brought to our attention when this bill was heard in Senate Judish, it wasn't until afterwards. So that's the reason for the amendments over here. And I also want to thank Ms. Metal for working with us as well on this. So I'll turn it over to Lieutenant Hackett.
Thank you, Lieutenant Hackett.
Thank you, Senator. My name is Del Hackett, and I'm a lieutenant with Lane County Sheriff's Office in Eugene, Oregon, and I'm here in support of Senate Bill 415A engrossed. This is a consensus amendment that is supported by the State Sheriff's Association, the Chiefs of Police, and the Oregon Department of Corrections. And again, this is fairly straightforward also. It simply corrects an oversight in the 1999 bill, which ultimately became ORS 181-860. And it simply adds corrections employees, certified reserve officers, telecommunicators, and emergency medical dispatchers to the list of public safety personnel that are defined in ORS 181-860. Currently, the Oregon Department of Corrections maintains peer support teams within their prison systems. Additionally, reserve officers, telecommunicators, and medical dispatchers could be involved in peer support counseling sessions and are in need of coverage as defined in ORS 181-860. And all that this does is add those particular classifications to those covered by the current statute.
So this would simply entitle them to participate in the
right, participate, and it offers the confidentiality of that's afforded sure. the other people that are currently listed in the statute.
And Diane, I assume that you don't have any objection to your bill being used as the vehicle for this.
Mr. Chair, we have no objection.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Shetterly.
Do I understand then that telecommunicator is defined somewhere else in the...
Mr. Chair, Representative Shetterly, I'll just take a shot at this, although it makes me very nervous to talk about this in front of a Judiciary Committee.
Should have been here yesterday.
The fact of the matter is that we looked at the definition, and it each section, in other words, 181-860 is a discrete area that has, for its own purposes, this definition. The statutes right next to it have a different definition, and Virginia Vanderbilt worked on this, and we were very careful in constructing this language to match it up with other language cleanup that had been done with BPST and others in 99. So she tried to make it as congruent with the definitions as possible, and the same person in LC handled it.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Shetterly.
A telecommunicator has a definition or has a particular meaning under Chapter 161 or 181?
I'll take that. Mr. Chair, Representative Shetterly, in 181-610 is where we'll find the definition.
Okay.
You're just worried that there isn't a...
Yeah, I'm a telecommunicator when I pick up the phone.
Okay.
Huh?
All right. Good. Thank you. Are there any questions for these witnesses? Okay, thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Hearing none, we will close the public hearing and open a work session.
Chair?
Representative Krieger.
Yeah, are the Dash 3s already in the...
They are not.
I'd like to move the Dash 3s of 415 into the bill.
Representative Krieger moves the Dash A3 amendments to Senate Bill 415. Is there any discussion as to the amendments? Is there any objection? Hearing none, the amendments are adopted. Representative Krieger.
I move 415A, the whole bill, to the floor with the due process recommendation.
to the full committee. Representative Krieger moves Senate Bill 415A as amended with the dash A3 amendments to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion, Representative Krieger?
No.
Okay.
Fine.
Any objection? The bill will move and we'll assign Representative Krieger to carry. Open a work session on House Bill 2801 and ask Representative Packard to come forward.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, State Representative Rob Patridge, House District 50. I bring the dash one amendments to House Bill 2801. House Bill 2801 is a bill that I've appeared before this committee on previously. It's in regard to child support. There's over $1 billion in uncollected child support in the state of Oregon that remains with Department of Human Services that is collected through local DA's offices and the Department of Justice. Child support is a significant problem in the state. As I told you previously, I was trying to create a tool whereby private individuals who feel like the state has exhausted their resources could then go out and allow a collection agency, private collection agency, to assist them, and the collection agency could receive some payment. I tried to work with the department on this on several occasions. I put together the dash one amendments that I believed would address most of their concerns. I sent those over to the department. The comment that I received, the only comments that I received back from the department on this were in a letter dated May 7th. The chair received a copy of those concerns. The concerns were twofold. One, that it does not satisfy the child support program's concerns of being required to be a middle person. They wanted to have it both ways. They wanted to protect the public, but at the same time, they don't want to be a middle person. And I don't know how you accomplish that goal of protecting the public without having them as a middle person. But their concern was the dash one amendments would have the payment go to the department, and then the department would divide the payment rather than it just being straightforwardly assigned to a collection agency. So I think you can't have it both ways. The department, on one hand, doesn't want to be the middle person, but on the other hand, wants to protect the public. And then two, in response to that as well, they said that they would have to maintain and develop a new form, which is required. The form provides the disclosure to protect the public that says that the obligee may be eligible for support enforcement services through DOJ or district attorney without paying any kind of fee. So it's clearly indicated, and they feel that it would have significant financial impacts and workloads impacts within the child support division. I sit, as many of you know, on the Full Ways and Means Committee, and also sit on the Department of Human Services budget. What it asked this committee to do is, since my perception after reading the comments in the letter are that that these are predominantly financial, is to allow this bill to go forward and send it to Ways and Means with the dash one amendments so that we can deal with the financial issues in Ways and Means and try and resolve the remainder of the issue. But time is getting short, and I wanted to fully disclose that to the committee because I've tried to deal with the department's concerns. We're one of the few states in the country who doesn't allow the assignment of child support payments. This is a hybrid which allows, I think, better public protection at the same time, not allow full-blown collection efforts.
Okay, thank you. Are there questions for Representative Patridge about 2801?
Yes.
Representative Vicki Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Patridge, I have not seen the letter from the department.
I need to give this to you.
Thank you, Representative.
I have a copy. If the
I don't have it here.
Okay.
I don't think it came to staff. It came to my office.
It came to the chair.
It was duly filed, and we'll get copies made if you'd like to read it. It's very short. Representative Vicki Walker, you could read the two paragraphs where they state their concerns.
Okay. Our objections to the proposed amendments are twofold. One, your proposed amendments do not satisfy the child support program's concerns of being required to be a middle person, in quotes, in a private contract between two private parties. Indeed, House Bill 2801-1 increases our concern with this because the CSP, which would be child support...
Payment.
payment.
Or program, excuse me.
Program would be additionally required after receipt of a new standardized form to divide and disperse the child support payment between the two private parties, the obligee and the private collection agency. Two, requiring the CSP, Child Support Program, to develop and maintain a new form and to divide and disperse the child support payment between the obligee and the private collection agency would have significant financial workload and systems impacts on the child support program, none of which are accounted for in the governor's budget. Okay. That does boil down to a financial concern on their part. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, Representative Walker, I think both of these boil down to financial concerns. I know that they don't want to be the middle person, but I don't know how they can have it both ways to not want to be the middle person and protect the public. I think that this is a good public protection measure because the payment still goes to the department, and the department then divides the payment.
So, can I ask another question? Representative Patridge, so the money still goes to the department, and then the department divides it. So we still have some controls over that. Okay, because that was my concern. You know, after the last meeting, someone handed me some stuff, and I went on the web this morning, and there are just tons of collection agencies out there on the Internet that say that we, you know, for a small fee plus any percentage of what we collect, we will get child support for you because state agencies are understaffed and overworked. And I just want some protection for the obligee in this matter, that they're not paying too large of a fee to a collection agency for this. And I saw Mr. Marquis handed you something.
Mr. Marquis was handing me a statute about assignment.
Okay. Okay. Well, that was just my question. Thank you.
Did you want... that's what I tried to do in the Dash 1 amendment. So,
right.
And I feel like I've done that. And
okay.
I know the department has some concerns, but I'd ask that we be able to handle this in the Ways and Means process because I think we could address these financially and with their IT system since I sit on both the IT committee and the DHS budget committee.
So, Representative Patridge, do you think it's – I mean, I get the sense that they actually think that the Dash 1s increased their problems as opposed to – not. I mean, is it your preference to get the Dash 1s on this or to have the original bill?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my preference is to adopt the Dash 1s because I think that they address Representative Walker's concerns about protecting the person who is to receive the child support payment and at the same time give a tool whereby it will encourage collection agencies. A collection agency normally functions on an assignment basis. They have a debt that is owed, it is assigned to them, and then they go out and collect. They collect the money, and then they divide the money and send part of the money to the person in which it is owed based upon whatever percentage. Now, in state government, we're requiring that uncollected debt, a lot of the uncollected debt, but not child support debt, be assigned to private collection agencies, and they receive a rate somewhere between 12 and 22% of what the debt is my understanding. What this would do would allow somebody, it would have to be by the obligee in a child support setting to request and file with the department a standardized form that discloses the percentage, and that they could pursue action through DOJ or district attorney's office to have child support collected. But this gives another tool in the toolbox of people who are owed child support, who need to feed their families, who need to send their kids to college, who need to do all these other things, and it's $1 billion hanging out there.
Okay. Yes, Representative Ackerman.
Yeah, Representative, I just have a few questions. Is the class of claim that we're talking about here a child support obligation that's usually been reduced to judgment and has not been previously assigned to the Child Support Division?
Who has not been previously?
Yeah. I mean, in some instances, the child support rights are assigned to the Child Support Division for collection.
These are the ones that would be assigned to the state and the DA's offices in the state for collection. If someone's paying their child support, if currently if someone's paying their child support,
right.
then that's a continuing obligation. But this would be to collect back child support that's due. Maybe I'm not following.
Well, in many instances, which I have some familiarity with, I think, the child support obligations are assigned to an appropriate state agency for collection. So you're not talking about these types of claims because the prior assignment would prevail. Isn't that correct?
No, I am talking about those types of claims as well. What's happened is, if you look at the uncollected child support, what's happening is we don't have the resource, the state doesn't have the resources, and all the local DAs don't have the resources to collect these. So people sit there who have past due child support, and the state either is not able to find the people through their district attorney's offices or Department of Justice. This would allow the individual who has become frustrated with that process to go to some private collection agency to do that. So they could be those which are assigned to those agencies.
Okay.
But this is not an assignment. Oregon law prohibits the assignment.
How can it not be an assignment if the collection agency is going to exercise some collection efforts, either on the judgment or otherwise, to collect the child support?
They still need that. What they would do is identify where these people are, what the stream of payment is. The department still would collect.
Oh, I see. Okay.
The department would collect, and then it would bifurcate the check between the collection agency and the individual who it's owed. That way, we deal with the consumer protection issues that Representative Walker asked that be dealt with.
Okay, so the collection agency basically does some investigative function, forwards that collection information to the appropriate state agency for collection purposes.
Correct.
And collects a fee for that. Is that how I see
it? That is correct.
Working?
Okay. Okay. Are there any further questions for Representative Patridge? All right. Thank you, Representative.
Chair.
Representative Shetterly.
I'll move the dash one amendments to House Bill 2801.
Representative Shetterly moves the dash one amendments to House Bill 2801. Is there any discussion? Representative Ackerman.
Well, I'm just looking at the collection agency may not charge a fee exceeding 20% for each child support payment received. Now, my hypothetical is that they find the debtor. There's a continuing child support obligation that has not been paid. Would that fee apply prospectively to all child support payments received thereafter, or retroactively only to accrued child support?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Shetterly.
Well, go ahead, Rob, but I'm looking on lines 9 through 11. The terms of an agreement between an obligee and a collection agency do not apply to support payments collected. Is that it? After 180 days from the date of the agreement was entered into? Was there a limitation there?
There's a limitation of 180 days, so it's not intended to be the prospective child support once they get back on a regular payment program.
Okay, does that answer your question, Representative Ackerman?
No, I'm still worried about the situation where they identify someone who has a prospective child support obligation. And the way I read this, they would take 20% of every child support payment received.
Within the 180-day period.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Representative Patrick, that is correct, within the 180-day period. You know, and you could contract for, they could put out a contract for less than that for the prospective child support payments. We're just trying to limit it so they're not obligated forever on the future collections, but it gives them a 180-day contract in order to collect the other.
Okay, thank you.
Does that satisfy your questions?
I think so.
Okay.
I have a question.
Representative Vicki Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Sit down there, Rob.
Yeah. Representative Patridge, I was going through some of these things that I downloaded from the Internet, and they charge a base setup fee, like this one charges $150, and then they charge an additional fee for collection. They take 28%. Do we limit? I don't really see that we limit the fee. You say the collection agency may not charge interest or a fee for its services exceeding 20%. So does that allow them to establish this space setup fee and then get money in addition to that?
They could charge a base setup fee. That is correct.
But it still can't exceed 20% of the support payment?
The total amount cannot exceed 20%.
Okay. Just checking.
Okay.
So the 20% is actually lower than many of these that I'm looking at in here. This one's 28, another one's 25.
Right.
So that's a reasonable amount.
Okay. All right, we have the motion pending. Is there any objection to the motion to adopt the Dash 1 amendments? Hearing none, they're adopted. Representative Shetterly.
Move House Bill 2801 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Shetterly moves House Bill 2801 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Representative Vicki Walker.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just hope that we are not processing, I mean, we're having such a problem with child support that our folks out there are feeling the need to go to a collection agency and pay a fee to get this child support that is duly owed them. But if we are in fact understaffed and unable to do that, and parents want to go out and use that service, I think Representative Patridge has met my concern about consumer protection in the Dash 1 amendment, and he can continue to work with the department about his other issues down in Ways and Means. So I'm okay with the bill now.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Vicki Walker. Is there any other discussion? Any objection to moving the bill as amended to the full committee? Hearing none, the bill will move to the full committee. Representative Vicki Walker, why don't you carry? Is that all right?
Okay.
I've gotten us excused until they absolutely need us on the floor so we can try to finish up. These all ought to be relatively quick. Not a lot of witnesses signed up, but we do need to... House Bill 3680.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3680, I would suggest we bring up Gina Skinner and Bill Hauser. You have I met with both of them. We drafted some amendments that are considerably narrow. You have the Dash 1 amendments before you. I believe Mr. Skinner and Mr. Hauser, Ms. Skinner and Mr. Hauser have been talking about some additions to this. What we did is we've narrowed the bill so that certain offenses would be allowed, certain misdemeanor offenses would be allowed into evidence for the purposes of impeaching the credibility of the witness, of the defendant. Now you can use felonies for those purposes. What we would use are certain misdemeanors that are usually involved in domestic violence. And we would only allow those in when the charge against the defendant were serious crimes listed in page 2. Many of these also would be arising from domestic violence situations. I believe Ms. Skinner may have some additions she'd like to add to the list of crimes to which we could use these misdemeanors for impeachment purposes.
Thank you. Why don't we, before I let you two start, why don't I give the committee an opportunity to inquire a little bit about the concept. Does everybody sort of get what this bill does differently than what the previous bill would have done? This bill essentially moves this whole issue over to a different section of the statute from what the original bill did, and it now creates a list of crimes which, if a person is thereof convicted, could be used as felonies are used in trial, particularly or narrowly in cases where the crime is one of domestic violence. So with that, why don't I let Ms. Skinner and Mr. Hauser talk briefly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Gina Skinner. I'm representing the Oregon District Attorney Association. I was here before this committee previously on House Bill 3680, and we have drastically changed what this bill is going to do. Before, we were talking about bringing in the substantive evidence prior domestic violence crimes, and that would be used as evidence for preponderance evidence under Evidence Code 404. What this bill is now going to do specifically under current Oregon law, if you're a defendant and you testify in any case, regardless if it's a shoplift or domestic violence or anything, If you have been convicted in the past of any felony or any crime, whether it's a misdemeanor or a felony, and it is one that is, there's a list in 609 in the evidence code, which talks about if you have, what did I say, things like theft, things like giving false information to a police officer, forgery, things that are considered that show that you are basically an untruthful person. And then at the end of the trial, the judge would give to the jury an instruction saying that that evidence can be used basically to show that this person is can be not a truthful person, and both felonies and those other kind of crimes. So it only comes in if the defendant testifies. So what we are seeking to do here is if the defendant is charged and the new crime that we are seeking, that we are in fact prosecuting or we are at trial to prove, is one of those that are listed on page 2 in the capital A through O as it's listed here. If that is the new crime, and what the ones that we wanted to add to that list was kidnapping in the first degree, kidnapping in the second degree, coercion, stalking, and burglary in the first degree if it's a domestic violence burglary. Burglary is not necessarily what you think it is. It's if you enter someone's home without their permission with the intent to commit a crime therein. Obviously, usually that's stealing, which is what people think of burglary, but you can break into somebody's house with the intent to commit the crime of assault inside and break into someone's house and beat them up or break them into their house and rape them, and that is also a burglary. And so that's what we would be talking about here. So those would be the ones we wanted to add. Now, if that is the new crime, then if the defendant testifies, currently, if they're charged again with a felony or they're charged with a misdemeanor that shows that they're an untruthful person, those already can be used. And the way it would come up, for those not familiar with trial work, is the defendant gets on the stand, testifies, and as a prosecutor, I would say, Mr. Jones, isn't it true that you've been convicted of the crime of theft in the first degree? And they would have to say yes. If they say no, then we provide the document that shows that they have, and we can enter that into evidence. And that's pretty much all that comes of it. What we're seeking to add to that is what's listed on page 1, which is if they've been previously convicted of assault in the fourth degree is a misdemeanor, menacing is a misdemeanor, harassment is a misdemeanor, and the two that I wanted to add to that was attempted assault 4, which would be a B misdemeanor, or attempted assault 4 felony, which is an A misdemeanor, because if it's an attempt, it goes down one level, and assault 4 felony is a C felony. Those come up quite frequently when you have felony assault 4 because the defendant's been previously convicted of assaulting the same victim, but it's an attempt, so then it makes it an A misdemeanor. Those are the ones that we would seek that would be added to the list currently that can be used to impeach the defendant's credibility in the case if they choose to testify. So the Oregon District Attorney's Association is in favor of these amendments. I mean, obviously they're very different from what we started out with, but we feel that this, again, is seeking to accomplish some of the goals that we have.
If I could just inject, the idea here was, as we talked about this bill in its original form, was to determine if there was a way to deal with past evidence of actions where someone had been involved in domestic violence against a particular family member, but yet balancing the test that you just can't introduce that evidence necessarily for its propensity that this person had committed the current crime. Currently in the law, as you all know, that if you've been convicted of a felony, that goes to your credibility, and that can be introduced as credibility evidence. And so the idea was then to pick some crimes that are essentially domestic violence related crimes and then say if you are being accused of this particular group of crimes, and you'll notice that it's that the defendant has been convicted of committing one or more of the following crimes against a family or household member is the limitation, then those could be added to the list of crimes, even though they were misdemeanor crimes, in which the evidence could be brought forward for a credibility test. So that's how the bill is structured. Mr. Hauser, you looked at the original dash ones. I'm not sure you've had an opportunity to consider the proposed additions by Ms. Skinner and whether or not that affects your position or lack of position on the bill is probably the better way to say it.
Representative Williams, my name is Bill Hauser. I'm with the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I have had an opportunity to go over the suggestions from Ms. Skinner, and our position, there are many members of my organization who don't like any change to this area of the law. However, this is a reasonable compromise in our opinion, and so we are relatively neutral on that. As far as the suggestions are concerned, they seem reasonable.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Hauser. Any questions for either Ms. Skinner or Mr. Hauser about how this might work? Representative Shetterly, I know you had some concerns about the original version of the bill. Is this a mechanism that is more comfortable to you based on...
Well put, more comfortable. I'm not enthusiastic about it, but I can support it.
Okay.
I do have a question about adding a B misdemeanor to the list of impeachment crimes, but if Mr. Hauser is willing to sign off, why, I'm not going to stand in the way.
Anybody else?
Thank you.
I think what we'll go ahead and do is ask Mr. Taylor, because the amendments are rather extensive, that you've recommended, Ms. Skinner, that we go ahead and ask LC to prepare the additions in a second, in a dash two amendment, so we can actually have that in front of us. And this is a fairly, you know, I mean, in the great scheme of things, it's not gigantic, but it's a big enough issue that I want the committee to have an opportunity to consider the amendment before we move on it. So it would be my intent to bring this back with the dash two amendments on Tuesday, which is really pushing us on our time schedule, but I think we probably need to do it in the form of a dash two. We could potentially move the bill up and consider the dash twos, but I'm not sure they could get them to us by tomorrow, full committee anyway, could they?
I don't know. I don't know. I really couldn't.
It's on the schedule for
tomorrow? Well, I think technically it is scheduled for tomorrow work session. Why don't we do this? Why don't we, if they can get us dash twos tomorrow, we'll consider it tomorrow. If they can't, we'll consider it on Tuesday. I guess to do that, I would need to move the bill to the full committee.
With conceptual amendments?
Well, or we could just consider the amendments at the full. We don't necessarily need to conceptually amend them either. We don't need to even consider the amendments, frankly. Oh. And I can move it without recommendation.
Okay.
So I'm just going to move the bill to the full committee without recommendation. And frankly, I don't even need a motion to do that. That's within my power as the chair, so I won't even call the roll. I'll just pull the bill to the full committee, and we'll consider the amendments when they're done. So there.
So, Mr. Chair, if the amendments are not ready tomorrow, then I'll put it on for full committee next Wednesday.
Next Wednesday, okay. Yeah. Okay. All right. Thank you. I'll close the work session on 3680. House Bill 3967, we'll open a brief work session. Ms. Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Good morning. For the record, my name is Nancy Miller. I'm the director of the Juvenile Court Programs Division of the State Court Administrator's Office, and with me is Aaron Ruff, our Juvenile Dependency Mediation Coordinator, and we'll try to make this brief. House Bill 3967 appropriates money to the Judicial Department to establish a dependency mediation program statewide. Basically, this is the second phase of the Judicial Department's implementation of the Adoption and Safe Families Act. That act was passed by Congress in 1997. It was an unfunded federal mandate on the courts. Those of you who were here last session heard about that at great length. The Adoption and Safe Families Act significantly reduced the timelines to get children out of foster care and increased the responsibilities of the courts to do that. It came to all the states with $0 for the courts. This body last session did appropriate money to the courts to help clear up the backlog of termination of parental rights cases and to fund the additional time it would take for permanency hearings, which were two of the big pieces of the Adoption and Safe Families Act. What we are doing with this bill is to actually continue a pilot that we started this past biennium with some very limited federal funds to implement dependency mediation. What we are hoping to do is to settle contested cases before contested jurisdictional hearings. What happens when a case is contested at jurisdiction
is that it takes a lot longer to resolve it. The parents don't engage in services until the contested jurisdictional hearing is held, and that often holds up the court's ability to meet those timelines in the Adoption and Safe Families Act. We did have an evaluation of this project done by the Center for Public Policy for Policy Research in Denver. They found that while they could only look at a very few number of cases because we just started the pilot, that our data was very consistent with the national data on dependency mediation across the country. And Aaron can tell you about that briefly if you'd like, but basically our deal here today is to ask you to pass this bill to Ways and Means. After the full committee, of course.
The bill has a $1 million fiscal.
Yes, Mr. Chair, it does.
And how you feeling about your chances down in the Ways and Means Committee right about now?
Well,
Tim Travis is doing the double thumbs up in the back, I want you to know. So.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, you all heard about the status of the Judicial Department's budget on the floor of the House when the budget passed. Because this is an unfunded federal mandate, the state court administrator gave us the okay to have a separate vehicle to fly it into Ways and Means and take our chances, and we're going to work on it.
Okay. Aaron, do you want to add something?
I don't think I need to take your time unless anyone has any questions. You have the evaluation, and I think the program speaks for itself.
Got my vote.
yeah, that's the way you get votes here. Yeah, talk less. No, we appreciate it very much, and it is a significant problem, and it's a significant. I mean, I like the idea of the way you sort of keep this process moving through the mediation process. So I think you've got a committee that, you know, if we took more time to talk about it, are very supportive. I think our only concern is we're sending you to a situation where your chances are relatively bleak. But don't let that get you discouraged.
Mr. Chair, our motto is never say die till Sonny dies.
Yeah, there you go.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Chair.
It just calls to mind my story about the toaster up in the House lounge where I call it the Ways and Means toaster. You put your bread in, and it goes down, and it doesn't spring back up. So, and when it finally does, it's toast, and it just kind of goes there and disappears.
It Ways comes and out.
There you go.
In pieces would be okay, Representative.
Crumbs. All right. We
get a fork.
We are in work session. I will move House Bill 3967 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on my motion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, the bill will move to the full committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Carrier? Didn't need to be one.
It didn't really need to be a carrier. We'll just. Okay. We are going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 655 and ask. Actually, we'll open up a public hearing on 656, too, and ask both Captain Ferris and Mark Landauer to come forward. And thank you for your patience this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Mark Landauer, the City of Portland's Office of Government Relations. We thank you for holding a hearing on both Senate Bill 655 and 656. I've asked Captain Jim Ferris, who heads the Portland Police Bureau's Drug and Vice Division, to briefly explain the two bills that are before you today, and we hope that we'll look kindly upon them. Thank you very much.
Captain?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Jim Ferraris, representing the Portland Police Bureau. I'll keep my comments brief and just advise you that Senate Bill 655 expands the crime of criminal trespass in the first degree to cover entering or remaining lawfully in a premise that's been determined not fit for use due to illegal drug manufacturing, primarily a meth lab, based on the decontamination requirements in the ORS as mandated by the Oregon Health Division. Senate Bill 656 expands the crime of child neglect in the first degree to include leaving a child or allowing a child to stay at a place that's not fit for use, again, due to illegal drug manufacturing, primarily meth labs. This is a chronic problem in our state, as you know. We've talked about this on previous occasions here at your committee. You have my testimony, and I'll leave it at that at this point and be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Captain. Are there any questions for either of these witnesses about these two bills? How big of a problem is it with people coming into you've shut down a lab, and you've got people reentering the premises. I assume to reclaim personal property and that sort of stuff. Is that typically what's going on?
No, quite honestly, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, that's not the case. There's a caveat built in to the bill for trespass that allows the property owner to come back onto the property as long as he wasn't part of the criminal case that shut the place down in the first place to get their personal property, et cetera. But we've had over 300 labs in Oregon in the year 2000. Over 100 of them were just in Multnomah County, and Coos County, I'm sure Representative Krieger is aware, it's a huge problem in Coos County. In more than half the cases that we know of, especially when there's a rental property involved, which is the primary place of choice for a meth lab, the occupants come back onto the property and just move back in before the place is decontaminated to health department or health division specifications under current law. So it's a chronic problem. We get these squatters come back, and we just don't have a tool to move them out of there.
Okay. Any other questions on either of these bills? If you glance at the testimony, you'll see some of the impact of having these children sort of in these areas and having the hair follicles test positive for methamphetamine and the like.
Mr. Chair, as you know, many of these chemicals are highly toxic, flammable, explosive, carcinogenic, and certainly we don't want these children to be victimized twice, which is often the case.
Counsel, do you have something to represent, Krieger?
Briefly, talking to some of our school people, we talk about the inability of these kids to even be taught in schools. That really affects them for years, maybe their lifetime. We don't know that yet.
Absolutely.
Council.
Mr. Chairman of the Committee, yes. Could you define what you mean by owner of record?
The owner of record is the person who owns the property. In the case of an apartment, the owner of record, Mr. Chair and Council, would be the property owner, vis-a-vis the property management company, if you will. Whoever is on the tax rolls for the county as listed as the owner is our opinion of who the owner record would be.
Let me give you an example. For example, let's assume that I own a warehouse in trust, and I have a lease with a company that has the leases the building for 7 years, or 10 years for that matter, and you discover a meth lab on there that no one knew that was there. Would the person who leases the property for 7 years be considered the owner of record so that they could go on the premises? Or would it be the person like myself who, say, I own the building?
My best guess, again, not being an attorney, but my best guess is that would be defined as whoever sublets it, whoever has the legal access to the property. So if I'm the tenant and you're the landlord of the building, am I not an extension of you to a certain degree?
I think, counsel, my experience with owner of record typically means who is the person listed on the tax rolls of the county having the ownership. At least that's in my other responsibilities with my Measure 7 committee. I've been spending a lot of time with the owner of record concept, and I think it's pretty clear that the owner of record is the person, if you go into the county clerk's office and dig through the titles, it's the person whose name appears on the title for that property. So there may be some issues about, you know, long-term leases and that sort of thing, but I think that it probably works the way it's written. Representative Ackerman, do you have a question?
Well, it probably then would not apply to a mortgagee.
Excuse me?
An owner of record would not apply to a mortgagee, a lender that had a security interest in the property that might be there to protect their interest somehow.
I would agree that it probably would not apply to a mortgagee.
Or a lessee.
Yeah, or a lessee.
Well, Mr. Chairman, certainly for the trespass, police use their discretion in issuing citations for that, and certainly if somebody is there for a legitimate purpose, they may very well not issue the citation and ask them to go get documentation from the person who has filed with the county.
Sure. Okay. All right, thank you. Any other questions? We'll close the public hearing on 655 and 656. We'll open a work session on Senate Bill 655. Chair would move Senate Bill 655A to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, the bill will move and all carry. We'll open a work session on Senate Bill 656.
Chair.
Representative Krieger.
I'll move Senate Bill 656 to the full committee.
Representative Krieger moves Senate Bill 656 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on this motion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, the bill will move. Do you want to carry that, Representative Krieger?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. And then our last bill, Senate Bill 318A. Mr. Hooper, we'll open a public hearing.
Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I am David Hooper, Public Affairs Manager with the Oregon Lottery, and thank you for considering Senate Bill 318A engrossed. This bill proposes a technical amendment to ORS Chapter 167, which governs in part the regulation of gambling. What the lottery is requesting in its change to law is to accommodate a very common practice by many of the state's citizens, which is possessing a lawful out-of-state lottery ticket. The Oregon Lottery came across this section of law as we were working with our family members, and just let me give you some family members of our employees. Let me give you some brief background. ORS 461-250 sub 8, section of the state lottery chapter states, a ticket or share shall not be purchased by, a price shall not be paid to, a member of the commission, the director, the assistant directors, or an employee of the state lottery. And then I've emphasized for you, or to any spouse, child, brother, sister, or parent of such person. We at the Oregon Lottery understand the public perception issues associated with an employee of the lottery or even one of their family members playing or, more importantly, winning a lottery prize. And we are, as employees, are willing to accept that as a condition of employment. We're not trying to change that part of law. However, when we tried to offer another state or a neighboring state's lotteries as an alternative to family members of employees who wish to play a lottery game and can't play Oregon's, we were advised that, in fact, any citizen of Oregon who purchased an out-of-state lottery ticket from a lawful lottery and brought it back to Oregon would be in violation of state law. Technically, they would be in possession of an illegal gambling record. Clearly, there are many Oregonians who regularly purchase tickets from neighboring states, Washington. I've provided some sales figures from a study done by Econ Northwest. $7.5 million in 1999 spent on gambling in other states. That does not include casinos, which were $123 million, actually. I correct my testimony, my written testimony for that. Or Washington State card rooms, another $12 million. So clearly there are many Oregonians who are purchasing what we would presume to be tickets from other state lotteries, and certainly neighboring states' residents frequently purchase lottery tickets. Yes, sir.
My Irish counsel, Mr. Taylor, wonders if he would be protected if he was purchasing an Irish sweepstakes ticket, so not from a neighboring state, but from a foreign country.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know that the law is quite that expansive. I don't know how Mr. Taylor would purchase his Irish sweepstakes, presumably while he was in Ireland.
Mr. Chair, when I was a kid, every old Irishman in Boston used to sell them. It wasn't legal, but they did.
I'm not sure that I can answer that question, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
But the language that was presented does talk to another state. I don't know that we're talking a foreign national.
I'm not sure we want to change.
Ireland, maybe, but.
Yeah, some of these other lotteries are a scheme.
British Columbia, huh?
Yeah.
Thank you, sir. That is why we have, in our attempt to amend this law, made it specific.
specific to another lawful lottery from another state. The bill, as originally written, merely created a defense when this bill was on the Senate side, the committee over there, and I believe, Mr. Taylor, you didn't service this bill on the Senate side. My apologies. The committee believed it was more practical to just create an outright exemption rather than a defense, and the amendments to that bill, what made the Senate Bill 318A engrossed, did in fact do that. It made a clear exemption. We don't expect that this change in law will certainly lead to any increase in what most citizens of this state undoubtedly believe is illegal activity. It is simply making that, frankly, I think, an update to state law, given the legalization of gambling that exists in Oregon as well as in neighboring states. I hope you'll agree it's reasonable, and we'll be glad to answer any questions.
Representative Ackerman.
I want to see if I'm interpreting this correctly. Is the Lottery Commission, by this statute, protecting its market position by imposing criminal penalties for the possession of out-of-state gambling tickets?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, if I understand your question, I believe we're doing just the opposite. If we were trying to protect our market share, we would have made it clearly illegal for anyone to go across state lines and bring back a lottery ticket. In fact, what we're trying to recognize is that many Oregonians do frequently buy neighboring tickets, tickets from a neighboring lottery, and we're trying to make it clear in law that it is not a violation of state law to do so.
If you have a ticket issued under the auspices of the laws of the state, but if I hold a ticket, lottery ticket or whatever from another state, I've committed a Class A misdemeanor?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ackerman, that's my understanding of what current law does.
Okay. I understand it's current law.
Yes.
Obviously, I didn't see this before today, but...
Are you looking at the Dash A, the engrossed version?
I suppose I am. I really object as a matter of policy to a state agency that's in basically a private enterprise situation protecting its market share by invoking criminal laws. I think that's terrible policy, but that doesn't reach the amendments, I understand. I'm speaking to the substantive enactment.
Again, Mr. Chair and Representative Ackerman, we are trying to enable Oregonians to play any legal lottery they wish to.
In Oregon.
As well as in a neighboring state. And that they could go to Washington State and buy that state's tickets and bring it back into the state and not be subject to criminal penalties.
Representative Ackerman, if I might, paragraph 3 of section 1 says the section does not apply if you get a lottery ticket from another state. So they're just making it legal. Because apparently anyone who's done that now has committed a violation of the law.
I missed it here.
Okay.
Very
does that satisfy your
I think so.
Questions? Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hooper. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 318. Open a work session.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Shetterly.
Move Senate Bill 318 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Shetterly moves Senate Bill 318 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on his motion?
I love arcane parts of the law that we fix.
Is there any objection? Okay. None. Anybody want to carry this? I've got some other lottery bills I'm planning to carry, so I don't want to hog them all up.
I don't mind carrying them, right?
All right. Representative Vicki Walker will be the carrier, and thanks for sticking with us.
Yeah, all right.
Bottom of
the list. But thank you very much.
Every once in a while, the rest one was a lot of things. They could never get a conviction.
They could never get a conviction because everybody on the jury had bought it.
Yeah. Yeah, you can imagine. So, what's the buzz on the text? Do we amend the text?